contemptible thing, driven by his own desperate fortune to such a strait that he must be delivered by a miracle or starve. And when he has beat his brains for some such miracle in vain, he finds no remedy but to paint up some bauble or other, as players make puppets talk big, to show like a strange thing, and then cry it up for a new innovation, get a patent for it, divide it into shares, and then all he has to do is make a sale. Ways and means are not wanting to swell the new whim to a vast magnitude. Thousands and hundreds of thousands are the least of his discourse, and sometimes millions, till the ambition of some honest coxcomb is to part with his money for it. And then the adventurer is left to carry on the project, and the projector laughs at him. The engineers build models and windmills to draw water, till funds are raised to carry it on by men who have more money than brains. And then goodnight patent and invention. The projector has done his business and is gone. The building of the Ark by Noah, so far as you will allow it as a human work, was the first project I read of. And no question seems so ridiculous to the graver heads of that wise, though wicked age, that poor Noah was sufficiently bantered for it. And had he not been set on work by a very peculiar direction from heaven, the good old man would certainly have been laughed out of it as a most senseless, ridiculous project. The building of Babel was a right project, for indeed the true definition of a project, according to modern acceptance, is, as I said before, a vast undertaking, too big to be managed and therefore likely enough to come to nothing. And yet, as great as they are, it is certainly true of them all, even as the projectors propose, that, according to the old tale, if so many eggs are hatched, there will be so many chickens, and those chickens may lay so many eggs, and those eggs produce so many chickens more, and so on. Thus it is most certainly true that if the people of the old world could have built a house up to heaven, they should never be drowned again on earth, and they only had to forget to measure the height. That is, as in other projects, it only miscarried, or else it would have succeeded.
Yeah. This is still what people are saying today, right? These old projects. If you look at the UN headquarters, it literally is designed to look like the fucking Tower of Babel.
Yeah, it all really begins at was with the creation of the Bank of England, at least, is that really opened up the possibility to do all these schemes. Because I went back and looked at the etymology of the term project, right? And it has an architectural origin from French to mean like an architectural projection, but then it gets taken up by the English in response to the gunpowder plot, where that's how they start describing it. So it immediately takes on this negative connotation that then goes into the political economy after the Bank of England, where now all these entrepreneurs are projectors.
Interesting. Something I've read as the origins of masonry, and specific, if we're talking about projects and you're saying it comes from this architectural lexicon, obviously we're going to run into the Masons here. And what's interesting is the separation between the speculative Masons and the operative Masons goes as far back as the organization of workers for building the cathedrals, which is where the whole Masonic organizations came from in the first place, were the people building the cathedrals. And essentially, the difference was the speculative Masons would nowadays be called the PMC, right? They were the project manager class, you could even say. Their job was to keep the total design of the cathedral in mind, because the whole project was going to take more than one lifetime to build. Their job is to keep the blueprints and to make sure that things are going according to the total plan in time. Whereas the operative Masons they're just organizing to fulfill the immediate tasks set down by the speculative Masons. This is the difference between on a construction crew even today, where you have the surveyors and like the project managers, as they're called, and then you have the actual builders.
That is really interesting.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking about that too. I've been thinking just about that aspect of masonry recently, is the literal aspect of like, okay, they're builders, right? I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, The Man Who Would Be King, with Sean Connery, where they're masons and they go into like Hindustan somewhere and to some lost kingdom. And the people there, they're masons, right? It's set up at the beginning of the movie. And then they get there and they think that they're going to conquer these lands based on their superior English wit and skill. And then the thing that actually puts them in charge is their Masonic emblems that they have. It's revealed that Alexander the Great had gone there. It's like in Bactria or wherever, right? Alexander the Great was a Mason. It has a whole thing. And it's like the people who built all of the great structures through history. But it's really building. And not so much the conspiratorial stuff is what I'd be interested in, but just the metaphor of building is such a big thing, because one of the things we've been discussing is the engineering schools that just proliferate around the later 18th century into the 19th century, the mechanics institutes that all the Saint-Simonians were trained at, and people like Robert Owen came out of one of them. And then in Germany, even they had them in Berlin with all the stuff around Helmholtz, right? It was all the technical schools. So it's all that's a huge driving factor here, is just the literal engineering.
The origin of those technical schools, right? Well, like the difference between, say, the more prestigious or religious education. I was reading just about this, and I finally got a copy of McLuhan's thesis on Thomas Nash. He talks about the war between grammar and dialectic in the trivium in the medieval university system leading up until the Elizabethan age. But there were other schools, though. There were like the merchant schools where you would learn calculation and things like this. And it was mostly, it was like a technical school. That ultimately becomes these sorts of engineering schools. But these schools were also the first places that Arabic numerals and things were being used first. That's also part of this general story, is the way that accounting or like technical financial education, calculating and things like this, that was originally a secular school for the merchant middle classes, right? Those guys wouldn't go to Oxford or Cambridge, but they studied math and science, essentially, as far as they knew at the time, in order to run their businesses. And the skills there, you know, you'd obviously be using Arabic numerals. You'd pick those up faster than in a medieval university where Arabic numerals doesn't really help you with solving the problems they're trying to solve. But keeping accounts, doing accounting, absolutely very important stuff. As this stuff becomes more and more important, it comes with the rise of this new intellectual class of people who have for generations just been studying in the technical schools, and they like don't really have a connection to the medieval university.
It's not until the neoclassical economists come about that the modern faculty of economics is developed at the university level, right? There was nothing before that. It was always tied into the curricula for ethics or history. So that's one of the big things that ends up happening with the development of economics as a specialization and profession that happens around 1900, is that they have the war, the dispute over method with Weber and the German historical school in order to assert their independence from other kinds of faculty, like the history faculty, because they wanted to have that independence. But it did take a long time because, like you said, there was no business training that you could get at a university, right? You just go to study law or study theology or, you know, study medicine.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to study business, like you said, that was the option, or you'd study at a firm in order to learn as you go. That's what David Hume did. Hume went to, you know, Oxford or whatever, I forget, but he didn't graduate. And then his real training in economics came when he worked at a merchant firm. And that's where he learned the political arithmetic of William Petty.
Yeah. I mean, you can sort of see like this all as being like the legitimization of like business as an art, in the same way that medicine or law are like considered art. That you can even see this, a split between the types of grad school that our elites go to, right?
Yeah. And this projecting stuff is like the canvas on which they were able to do that, right? Because then it did become an art, because then you have to go into the public sphere and use rhetoric and make advertisements for yourself and explain to people what you were doing. And so you had to have these visions that would capture people's imaginations, right? People didn't really want necessarily sensible projects. If you wanted to go and get the public support for the credit that you needed and the public finance, and you needed to have these bold projects like the Saint-Simonians end up doing. We're going to build the Panama Canal. We're going to build the Suez Canal.
Yeah. I mean, you got to get the people going.
The South Sea Bubble is one of the big things that happens right after the Bank of England is formed. These were always so fucking corrupt from the very beginning. That's why it's funny to compare it to entrepreneurship today. It's the same basic thing. These were the Elon Musk visionaries of the late 17th century. Let's go fucking found all these plantations in the New World, right?
Yeah, industrial romance. Yeah, and we're going to build mega projects. It's just the same shit forever, man. That's why we have to go to Mars and all this other stuff. The way that they conceptualize it, like the people who are doing this, is that they're kind of ennobling people who are just working for no real point, but like if they can like be inspired to believe they're somehow contributing to this project of building, then you're providing meaning in life, people. That's sort of the way that someone like Elon Musk even cognizes himself, is like, my existence brings joy to people because I'm incarnating their dreams of projects.
That's the whole metaphor of the building again, because that's literally what it is just, we're going to build the whole world. We got to build the world system. that's how they've been conceptualizing it since the 17th century, at least, is this was the canvas that they were going to paint on, and they had to design a new world. I think that's part of what the utopian literature is really about, obviously. But then if you look at Swift, if you look at Gulliver's Travels, that's what he's satirizing, I think. And Defoe's first novel is about going to the moon and doing that, actually. I don't know if you know about that one. It's one of the lesser known ones. It's actually kind of a difficult read, but
that whole idea of going to the moon to build projects is so fucking old, too. This is just it's like Lukean satire, like a true story. That idea of it being simultaneously a utopian vision of going to the moon and building stuff there, the way that people still treat 20th century NASA, but also like a parody of that idea of it being on its face absurd and stupid. Oh, we're going to build shit on the moon. Like, why? What's the point?
Chapter 2. The humors and dispositions of the Laputians described. An account of their learning, of the king and his court, the author's reception there, the inhabitants subject to fear and disquietudes. At my alighting, I was surrounded with a crowd of people, but those who stood nearest seemed to be of better quality. They beheld me with all the marks and circumstances of wonder. Neither, indeed, was I much in their debt, having never till then seen a race of mortals so singular in their shapes, habits, and countenances. Their heads were all reclined, either to the right or the left. One of their eyes turned inward, and the other directly up to the zenith. Their outward garments were adorned with the figures of suns, moons, and stars, interwoven with those of fiddles, flutes, harps, trumpets, guitars, harpsichords, and many other instruments of music unknown to us in Europe. I observed here and there many in the habits of servants, with a blown bladder fastened like a flail to the end of a stick, which they carried in their hands. In each bladder was a small quantity of dried peas, or little pebbles, as I was afterwards informed. With these bladders, they now and then flapped the mouths and ears of those who stood near them, of which practice I could not then conceive the meaning. It seems the minds of these people are so taken up with intense speculations that they can neither speak nor attend to the discourses of others without being roused by some external action upon the organs of speech and hearing. For which reason, those persons who are able to afford it always keep a flapper, the original as Climinole, in their family, as one of their domestics, nor ever walk abroad or make visits without him. And the business of this officer is, when two, three, or more persons are in company, gently to strike his... gently to strike with his bladder the mouth of him who is to speak, and the right ear of him or them to whom the speaker addresses himself. This flapper is likewise employed diligently to attend his master in his walks, and upon occasion to give him a soft flap on his eyes, because he is always so wrapped up in cogitation that he is in manifest danger of falling down every precipice, and bouncing his head against every post, and in the streets of jostling others or being jostled himself into the kennel. It was necessary to give the reader this information, without which he would be at the same loss with me to understand the proceedings of these people as they conducted me up the stairs to the top of the island and from thence to the royal palace. At last we entered the palace and proceeded into the chamber of presence, where I saw the king seated on his throne, attended on each side by persons of prime quality. Before the throne was a large table filled with globes and spheres and mathematical instruments of all kinds. His Majesty took not the least notice of us, although our entrance was not without sufficient noise by the concourse of all persons belonging to the court. But he was then deep in a problem, and we attended at least an hour before he could solve it. He spoke some words, whereupon immediately a young man with a flap came up to my side and flapped me gently on the right ear. But I made signs as well as I could that I had no occasion for such an instrument, which, as I afterwards found, gave His Majesty and the whole court a very mean opinion of my understanding. The king, as far as I could conjecture, asked me several questions, and I addressed myself to him in all the languages I had. When it was found I could neither understand nor be understood, I was conducted by his order to an apartment in his palace, where two servants were appointed to attend me.
Defoe is kind of in between, where obviously he's a merchant. He's interested in promoting his own projects, but he has a problematic relationship with it, where he was satirizing certain projects and he's critical of it and he knows the dangers of it, but he also is not, you know, he also sees the potential. But then if you look at Swift and Pope and Gay, then they're super negative about it. They just rip into it in every chance that they get in all of their works.
Yeah.
In The Beggar's Opera, when Jonathan Wilde, the criminal, the thief taker general, is transformed into Walpole. That's what, if you don't know, Jonathan Wilde, he's a famous criminal from that era, from the early 18th century. And his whole thing was he's the thief taker general, where he allied with law enforcement publicly and pretended that he was like a bounty hunter or something, or that he was giving the law enforcement of the time information that would lead to catching these criminals. But he was also the mastermind who was leading all the conspiracies of the criminals. And then he would be blackmailing the criminals that he was working with, turning them over for rewards. And so Jonathan Wilde...
So he's like Whitey Bulger.
Yeah, no, exactly. And then Jonathan Wilde was so famous, obviously, that there's a bunch of works about him. Defoe wrote an account of his execution when he finally got hanged. But, you know, then there's Fielding's has a novel, Jonathan Wilde, which is all about this, where it plays on the whole deceptive aspect of projecting your public self, right? So that's what Jonathan Wilde is good at. He's good at being duplicitous and projecting a version of himself that isn't real, and then using that to manipulate people. So there's that big danger of the personality construction in the same way that everything else is being constructed. But then in John Gay's Beggar's Opera, which is one of the biggest successes of the stage of the time, is that has Jonathan Wilde in it too. And that's like a satire of the explosion of the South Sea bubble. And so Jonathan Wilde there is satire of Walpole, the first prime minister, who is engaging in the misdeeds of the South Sea bubble, profiting off of it.
Yeah. So this is like the origin of the dual role of an intelligence asset, where they're organizing crime in order for it to be controlled. They kind of work as the justified sinner of the economy in a way, where the worst thing in the world would be just crime that people don't know how it works or what's going on. It's much better to have crime that you just control as like another department. You can see this going back to the use of privateers in the English Navy for a long time, where there's always been pirates and piracy in the British Isles for centuries, if not millennia. And the ability eventually to get them on board and to instrumentalize them is the first step towards instrumentalizing crime in general.
And you saw, too, that I showed you that thing about Samuel Pepys informing naval intelligence at this time, too, right? That's where the Royal Navy's intelligence capacity originally comes from, is Samuel Pepys basically setting that down. But intelligence, because there's also, along with the concept of a projector, there's also the concept of an intelligencer, right? That's what Samuel Hartley was into.
Yeah.
That was the big thing that he was super interested in, doing even these mechanics institutes and intelligence and being an intelligencer, which is amazing when you think about William Petty. He proposed stuff like a gymnasium mechanicum, or a college of tradesmen and things like that. It's a very continuous project that they were working on to develop basically an overall intelligence capability of some kind. And that is extended through Baconianism into basically everything. But even when you look at the 20th century and how our modern intelligence agencies were formed, it really is, I think, as I've talked about in previous episodes with Ed, it's against that backdrop of wanting to improve our general knowledge of foreign languages as a nation, of what's going on in Eastern Europe, and developing expertise in a very serious way. Scholars were very important in doing that. That's what Walter Lippmann even is talking about when he talks about the need for a central intelligence agency in public opinion. He frames it in that same way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's because it's a new type of role that it exists kind of in nascent form in earlier times, where you have just privy councils, that sort of thing. But these aren't people whose jobs were primarily to do intelligence. Like, the closest you can come to that is really the eunuch courts and harems and stuff like that of the Ottoman Empire, which is probably some of this comes from, at least as when it comes to creating these sorts of intelligence network. You could say that the projector or the intelligencer is kind of like the imperial eunuch.
It's funny, too, because a lot of it does happen in the Restoration, really, with how the Royal Society is formed. It's through John Evelyn, right, and his position close to Charles II, that he's able to get the royal patent to form the Royal Society. So from the very beginning, having a relationship with the state was always important. And that's the context of where political economy is developing, too, where we have the idea from classical economics from Adam Smith that it's all laissez-faire, but it's really the physiocrats in the later 18th century economic thinkers who turn to the laissez-faire direction. But in the late 17th century for like William Petty, is that they don't have that same conception of free market, free trade, invisible hand or anything, is that they very much believe in a conjunction, a cooperation between merchants and the state, and in order to amass wealth for the nation. They believe in intervention very strongly.
Yeah, it's kind of funny also the way that it exists in the Restoration is because Charles II, he has the cabal, called the cabal as an anagram for the five main people that he had, whose last names were obviously starting with a C, then an A, then a B, then an A, then an L. And there's like tension between a private intelligence network in the sense of the president coming in, like say Trump coming in and putting in all his own guys, like a kind of patronage system of a privy council, versus this idea of a professionalized privy council.
Having a class of experts to rule things.
Like meritocratic experts.
That would be able to use scientific methods. Yeah. Scientific, like established scientific methodologies in order to tell you how the economy should be run. And that did cause a lot of tension, really, because I think that's why the Stuarts lost a lot of their support, was even because they were actually turning to the technocratic nascent experts to tell them about how the East India Company should be run and things like that, and tell them about economic value. So they were relying on Josiah Child and William Petty in order to sketch out those theories. And it did create a tension between these established people and then these people like Samuel Pepys and William Petty, who were maneuvering through these multiple regimes, going through the Protectorate and then making it through the Restoration, and using their actual knowledge and their intelligence abilities and these new sciences that they were developing in order to just be so much use that they were able to avoid having these partisan fallouts and getting executed or any consequences like that.
Yeah, because their political power isn't beholden to a specific network of agents. It's to the projects themselves, or to these sorts of third types of institutions, where their usefulness is their instrumentality. They could be used by any regime because they're meritocratic experts, the way that the CIA will be used by a Democrat or a Republican. Whereas if you're head of the Chamber of Commerce, your job kind of depends on whether or not there's a Republican or a Democrat in office to like put you in or take you out.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. William Petty was valuable with regards to Ireland either way, because he was able to conduct the down survey for it and do the demographic surveys of the people to understand who's there. And it didn't matter one way or the other, whether or not it was during the Protectorate or it was under the Restoration. And another thing I wanted to talk about, too, is Restoration theater, because I haven't really read any Restoration theater, I realized. So I've been looking into that a little bit. One of the things that John Brewer, one of his thesis that he makes in one of his books is Pleasures of the Imagination. He talks about how the House of Hanover, right, is that they were not very publicly engaged, at least through George I and George II. And they had Whitehall Palace, which was being built for a long time. And then the Hanoverians gave that project up and receded into much more contracted realm. The size of their court shrank over time, and they didn't really do much except they got Handel to come over, obviously, and they replaced Italian opera with that. But otherwise, they disengaged from the role of being cultural patrons and being representational culturally through their court. And then John Brewer theorizes about how that allowed the proliferation of private societies like the Kit Kat Club and those kinds of groups in order to step in and become kind of a distributed system of court patronage, where all these independent societies were all fragments of the court or aspects of it, proliferated around society and then distributed the task of the court to all these private associations.
Yeah, you no longer have a centrally planned culture, but it's like a market of the theatrical market.
I think what Brewer is getting at is summed up in an actual quote by the Sun King himself. Louis XIV, he says, "Those people are gravely mistaken who imagine that all this is mere ceremony." He's referring to his court at Versailles. "The people over whom we rule, unable to see the bottom of things, usually judge by what they see from the outside. And most often, it is by precedence and rank that they measure their respect and obedience. But it is important to the public to be governed only by a single one. It also matters to it that the person performing this function should be so elevated above the others that no one can be confused or compared with him. and one cannot, without doing harm to the whole body of the state, deprive its head of the least mark of superiority distinguishing him from the limbs. You can find further exploration of this idea in a book called The Culture of Power and the Power of Culture, Old Regime Europe, 1660 to 1789. It's by T.C.W. Blanning. His theory of what he calls the representational court is what I believe Brewer is also talking about in the dynamics he sees evolving between the relationship between the royal court and between private societies and the public sphere. It's like we've seen with Locke, how everything is external, how God has created this external order, this external world, which acts upon us, and we make all of our actions in accordance with the pain and pleasure that that world inflicts on us. But then with Shaftesbury and with the Scottish common sense philosophers, that begins to change, and there's a subjectification that happens. This is the problem we see in the quest for the universal language of Leibniz. It's the problem of representation generally, and the way that words and the things they refer to are disconnected, and the way that the sign and the signified, the way that they're decoupled. In the 17th century, the collapse of the Tower of Babel, the representational court of Versailles is an attempt to will or manifest this decoupled authority back into reality. As we've seen with the subjectivist tendency here, as Habermas discusses, the law becomes neutralized. It's likewise decoupled from the mores and the customs and the public opinion and the tradition. Whereas before, the monarch or the sovereign would implement or design the laws in the same vein as Locke conceives of the natural order, where the laws impose, the mores, the customs, the public understanding, the common sense understanding of right and wrong. He enacts those through the laws positively, and man just makes decisions in accordance with those and is rewarded or punished according to what those laws say, per what Habermas says, his whole model. With this transformation that's happening around the turn of the 18th century, that aspect of the law is abstracted into public opinion. And as we've also seen with Adam Smith's Spectator Society as well, those mores are enforced, with every individual assuming a place like that of a spectator in his own mind, judging himself and how his actions would make others feel in accordance with these narrative rules of sentimental literature, which the sentimental literature then trained readers about the conventions of this new way of doing things, of this new morality, of this new system. You would assume this generalized rational perspective as this universal observer, view your own actions as if you were, you know, reading a novel, you were a character in a novel. And then you would judge whether or not from that universal impartial perspective, whether or not your behavior was in accordance with those mores. That's what happens in England. And that's allowed especially to flourish with the retreat of with the Hanoverian dynasty and the way that the court shrinks and the way that they're domesticated according to this new domestic sphere, private sphere that's in opposition to the new public sphere. But in France and in other parts of continental Europe, that wasn't the case. Transformation took longer and was more directly opposed by the sovereign and by the monarch, especially in France and especially with the case of Louis XIV, which is what Versailles is really all about. It's a fight against this abstraction, against this flight of the objective moral order into the realm of abstraction and subjective reason and sentiment. It's like that old world is evaporating. He's trying to will it back, force it back into realities to prevent it from vanishing forever. And so it concentrates progressively and more into Versailles. You know, whereas the sovereign's connection to the mores and the morality of society, whereas previously they had spread all throughout the country and all through the cities and was everywhere and omnipresent and pervaded everything, it was being pushed back by the growing public sphere, and it condensed down and down and down into a smaller and more densified object. And that took the form of Versailles in France. And so by making this extreme representational example, that was the way that Louis XIV wanted to maintain the sovereign's authority over the moral order.
My dinner was brought, and four persons of quality, whom I remember to have seen very near the king's person, did me the honor to dine with me. We had two courses of three dishes each. In the first course, there was a shoulder of mutton cut into an equilateral triangle, a piece of beef into a rhomboides, and a pudding into a cycloid. The second course was two ducks trussed up in the form of fiddles, sausages and puddings resembling flutes and oboes, and